This podcast of The Business is a production of KCRW Santa Monica at 89.9 FM, webcast at kcrw.com, and distributed by NPR.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business? And you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that. And prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, will Hollywood's new Wall Street chums become food for showbiz sharks? Then, a Wall Street banker puts his mouth where his money is and tells us about investing his own cash in a new indie film. And finally, the writer speaks again. But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Shut off your BlackBerry. It's The Business from NPR. It was strange days on Capitol Hill last week as Sirius Satellite Radio CEO Mel Karmazin once again tap-danced in front of the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee. Quote, "If consumer choice and lower prices equals the public interest," Karmazin said of Sirius's planned merger with XM Radio, "then we believe we've achieved that." In the same breath, Karmazin then rejected a proposed a la carte pricing structure. He also admitted that if you want both XM and Sirius, it'll cost you $25.90, a savings of, wait a minute, that's not a savings. Meanwhile, back on Earth, terrestrial radio listeners sick of endlessly hearing the same shop-worn pop tunes may soon encounter surprising new bands on the dial. Four enormous broadcast conglomerates, Entercom, Clear Channel, Citadel, and CBS Radio, have agreed to pay hefty penalties totaling $12.5 million to settle accusations of taking record companies' bribes. They've also agreed to provide about 4,000 hours of airtime to small record companies and local artists. It's supposed to end payola, wherein record labels give fat envelopes of cash to radio station employees who play songs by the label's artists. In other regulatory news, the FCC demanded last week that the cable business start deploying set-top boxes with a removable security component starting in July. What's the big deal? The new requirement means that set-top boxes from various cable companies should become interchangeable, which means you don't have to pay for a new box when you leave Kentucky and come to Tennessee. And it also means retailers will probably begin offering combination DVD players, TiVos, and set-top boxes all in one. In other words, that terrifying, precarious stack of plastic boxes piled next to your TV, it could finally disappear. Maybe you'll buy a plant. Finally, it's been almost a year since confidential FBI documents and witness statements were leaked to the New York Times in the wiretapping case of private investigator Anthony Pelicano. Now, attorneys to the former PI to the Stars are pushing for a federal inquiry into the source of those leaks. The main suspects? Brad, Scooter Gray, Michael, Scooter Ovitz, and Bert, Scooter Fields. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Coming up later, we're making a movie. Want to invest? But next, Wall Street comes to Hollywood in a big, big way. The streets of Hollywood are littered with the empty wallets of rich guys who came to town with sacks of cash and stars in their eyes. And even large companies have been run out of town after getting their assets kicked. The last 20 years have been a particularly tumultuous time to be the new guy in town. First came the Japanese. In 1989, Matsushita purchased Universal Pictures and Sony purchased Columbia Pictures. Even camcorder giant JVC invested in movies, making films like Time Cop and Point Break. But what the Japanese electronics manufacturers didn't get was that making movies isn't like making the VCRs they play on. Just because you've spent a certain amount doesn't mean you can expect to get back a certain amount. In fact, you're almost always sure to lose your money on at least a few films. In late 1990, the Japanese stock market crashed. Shortly thereafter, Matsushita unloaded Universal in a fire sale, and most other baffled Japanese investors in Hollywood were only too glad to be rid of what they saw as an irrational pit bull of a pet that had turned on them. Then, in the mid-1990s, it was the insurance industry's turn to feed Fido. Giant insurers like AXA provided collateral for loans made by megabanks like Chase. But the banks were only financing the films because the insurance companies were backing the loans. It was an unintentional financial suicide pact that would end in millions of dollars of litigation. While the insurance companies got busy suing the banks, a new group of Dummkopf showed up. The Germans. As the millennium drew to a close and the internet bubble swelled, instant wealth was created on their newer marked exchange, the equivalent of our high-tech NASDAQ, and it gave Teutonic titans more than enough cash with which to get into trouble in Hollywood. Before you could say schnitzel, there was a bloodbath when the newer market bubble burst, along with the NASDAQ in early 2001. Now there's a new investor in town, and their bankrolls dwarf anything Hollywood has seen before. To them we say, caveat emptor. The business producer Matt Holzman has more.
Let's get one thing perfectly clear. OPM, that's other people's money, has been around Hollywood since there's been a Hollywood, and it always will be.
You can go all the way back to three Wall Street companies investing in the conversion to sound, coming in with Bell Labs.
Gigi Johnson is a media financial consultant and the former executive director of UCLA's Anderson Media Management Institute.
Other people's money has been the driving force in Hollywood for a very long time.
Rich people have always thrown money at the movies, often as much for the girls and the glamour as for the potential guilt. But in the last 25 years or so, investing in the movies has become more sophisticated, though it's still risky. By the early 80s, you didn't even have to be super rich anymore to invest in the movies. A group called Silver Screen Partners raised $1 billion from thousands of individuals for a slate of Disney films. Gigi Johnson worked in banking for 10 years, putting exactly these kinds of deals together before she came to UCLA.
The challenge is the studios are picking the films that go into these pots. And so they're not putting all their films in these pots. They're putting some of their films in these pots. And you're hoping that the decision process is such so that you're not on the wrong side of a very strange blackjack game.
As in any casino, the house has the advantage. In the case of investment pools like Silver Screen Partners, the house advantage came from the fact that the studio got paid first through a distribution fee, after which it would stick the investors with the riskiest films. After all, why would the studio give up the upside to slam dunk movies? Oddly enough, it was a change in the tax laws as much as bad deals that more or less put an end to many of the foreign and domestic investment schemes.
Every, 3 years, government suddenly goes, that's not what we meant for that tax law to do. Let's change the laws.
But there's a new investor in town that's making a serious impact on how show business does business. Bill Mechanic was CEO and chairman of Fox Studios from 1996 to 2000 when this money was really starting to flow.
I think these are incredibly smart people. Whether they're incredibly astute about this specific business is the only issue, but these are not stupid people. They're not just smart, they're smarter than most of the people I deal with out here.
The people Bill Mechanic are referring to are the hedge fund managers. Hedge funds invest large pools of cash for institutional investors and really rich individuals. They're less regulated than, say, mutual funds, so they can put their money in just about anything. They use that freedom to hedge their bets so that their clients' money is growing whether the market is up or down. But a studio's fortune is a roller coaster, so why are the hedge funds willing to ride? Gigi Johnson.
Well, entertainment has a somewhat of an unquenchable appetite for capital.
The entertainment industry has the dubious distinction of being able to swallow as much money as it can get its mouth around. The hedge funds have so much money, $1.4 trillion in 2006, that they're running out of places to invest. Reportedly, hedge funds have so far invested $4 billion in Hollywood, and they seem to be playing it smarter than many past investors. Some have been successful in getting a piece of a wide slate of a studio's pictures, not just the high-risk films. The $225 million Melrose Fund, named thusly because Paramount is located on Melrose Avenue, was able to wangle a deal to invest in Paramount Pictures' internal rate of return. That is, they get a piece of everything where Paramount makes money on a movie. Home video, merchandise, everything. By the way, this is a better deal than even most superstar actors or directors ever get. So why are the studios willing to play the game with these new rules?
You kind of almost making it analogous to some industrial project.
Jonathan Dolgen was chairman and CEO of Viacom Entertainment, the parent of Paramount Pictures, from 1994 to 2004.
Where one aircraft manufacturer can't afford the risk of one project and has to share it with others. You know, they're just so big. What do you say about a $300 million number? You're gonna sit on a Friday night saying, I have $375 million of risk tonight? You know, it could make it for kind of a strange, unpleasant Saturday.
So why don't the hedge funds just invest in aircraft manufacturing, you ask? Because while mature industries that make planes or breakfast cereal are safe investments, they'll never return the kind of wowza profits that Hollywood promises. Even the terrible year that Paramount released the film Dickie Roberts' Child Star, their internal rate of return was 15%. A big hit could push a studio's internal rate of return to 28%. Try getting that in a money market account. The problem is, when you play with other people's money, you may not be as careful with it. Bill Mechanic.
They're not $100 million movies. They're $200 million movies, and some of them are now pushing, you know, between two and three. That those costs are skyrocketing in part because people are only looking at taking half the risk.
The studios were starting to realize that movie budgets were out of control, and they might have got a handle on huge director and star salaries, wildly expensive special effects, and marketing budgets that are more than whole films used to cost. They might have got a handle on these things until the hedge funds started to pour obscene amounts of money into the system. And that money could have more than just a financial impact. Jonathan Dolgen.
You're going to make 20 mil films a year. How that money, where that money comes from, shouldn't be influencing the decision. It's just, I think it's a potentially corrupting notion. When you do that, I think you end up getting in trouble.
There is a quiet conversation going on in Hollywood about whether, in the end, all this investment capital is a good thing or not so much. Bill Mechanic.
I always felt it was important to feel the risk, that decision of, you know, should you win or lose on your own, you know, skill set was a good one. And that when you simply say, I can't bring my costs down, and you're looking for somebody to share that risk, then you're probably not doing your job effectively.
The hedge fund-fueled Relativity Media alone could gamble more than $1 billion into movies in the next few years. So the question has to be, will the hedge funds beat the bank at the Hollywood casino, or will they leave town with their pockets turned inside out? Gigi Johnson of UCLA.
I'm very cynical on this topic because we've got decades of experience with various people coming in with new money thinking that they're more sophisticated and savvy than the studios.
And have they all fared?
There's been lots of lawsuits over time. Most of these new structures have had some interesting glitch or another.
Movies can pay big profits, provided you've got a few years to wait around for them. A typical film needs at least 5 years to earn all its revenue from theaters, home video, merchandise, and TV. But the people who own stock in the media conglomerates like Viacom and Time Warner that own the studios aren't interested in long term. They care only about three quarters, last quarter, this quarter, and next quarter. And until a movie pays off, the millions spent on it are just a big blotch of red ink on the studio's balance sheet. Now, all this hedge fund money we've been talking about doesn't show up on the studio's books, so it makes their bottom line look much, much better. So the irony is, the studios are turning to Wall Street to solve problems created by Wall Street. Maybe Hollywood's finally met its match. For The Business, I'm Matt Holzman.
Coming up next, Mickey and Judy are putting on a show. Get out your checkbooks.
Hey, Mickey, the rehearsals are going fine.
Yeah, but the bankroll isn't. If I could only run into an angel.
You mean as a special attraction for the show?
No.
An angel would be a novelty.
No, not that kind of an angel, Pat. I mean the back of somebody to put some dough into the show.
In indie film, the most common funding, if not the largest sums, actually come from what's known as F&F money, that is, friends and family. In this time-honored tradition, someone who wants to make a movie asks everyone within their gene pool to put up a few bucks for the project. In these very personal deals, the glamour of Hollywood is often as big an attraction factor as the possible rate of return. Zach Goldberg was a college buddy of mine, but he managed to overcome that and became a managing director at Bear Stearns in Boston. Now you can add the title of film financier to his resume. He's just invested in the low-budget indie film Blue State from first-time director Marshall Louis and starring Anna Paquin. Zach Goldberg, welcome to The Business.
Thank you.
How did you come to be a motion picture investor? Who told you this would be a good idea?
The producer is a guy named Andrew Paquin, and the guy that I work with went to college with him. They were actually college roommates. Andrew's sister is Anna Paquin.
So how did they reach out to you and say you should be an investor in this movie?
I'm good friends with the guy that I work with here. We both work in the same group, and so he was kind of just updating me all along about how he's investing in this movie, and he was extremely excited about it, and at one point asked me if I wanted to invest. So,
mm-hmm. And you said?
Initially I said no, but I guess what ultimately made the decision for me is that I felt like it was being managed extremely well, and I felt like my downside was limited, and I felt like I could actually make some money.
So how much did they ask you for?
Well, I'd rather not say.
Under $100,000, let's say.
Under $100,000, yes.
Okay. And I would imagine for you that's a fairly sizable chunk of change.
Put it this way, if I lost that money, I would be extremely upset about it.
Okay. But you'd be okay. You wouldn't be eating cat food.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
But you wouldn't be happy either.
I'd be beyond upset. I would be livid.
Okay. So what was the deal they offered? I mean, like, how big an investor are you in this? Are you the primary stakeholder or not?
No. That's a good question. I'm not. I'm on the lower end.
And is the movie being financed entirely through people like you who said, I'm in for this much and I'm in for that much?
Exactly. It really is. I think there are a lot of people in the financial community who did it. And I think everyone, I don't know, was excited to do something different and something exotic and really kind of live the Hollywood dream.
Mm-hmm. And what were you hoping to get out of this?
Well, first of all, I wanted money out of it. That's number one. Number two, I thought it would be a fun experience. I thought, you know, I've always been interested in Hollywood. I think I've always had some regret that I did not go to Hollywood and right after college. And, you know, it was just a way where I thought I could learn about it and have fun. And I guess I met the principals involved and was extremely impressed.
The principals being the producers or the creative team?
Actually, both. The producer and the director. The director wrote the script.
Mm-hmm. Did they offer you any guarantees? Like, No.
Not at all.
Help me understand this here. I mean, you're writing a big check.
There are a fixed number of units, and each unit is a certain denomination, and so you can buy as many as you'd like, and that's how this one got funded.
How does it work with these shares? When you buy these, what did you call them, units?
Yes.
That entitles you to recoup at a certain point, or how does it work? Explain it a little bit. And once I've bought my units, what happens next?
Well, let's say the movie costs $100,000, and let's say that the units are $5,000 each. So if you buy one unit, you basically own 5% of the film.
Okay. And then how do I make my money back? I mean, is it after it goes into theaters, after it goes onto video, after, like, when do I get paid?
Well, it's funny. I mean, probably not entirely clear about that. But I mean, obviously, you need revenues coming in. You need the film to recover its costs. And so, you know, beyond that, there's a split, and that's basically how it works.
At any point, did you discuss what kind of credit you would receive? Are you going to be in the credits of the movie?
I will be in the credits, but I don't really know anything beyond that.
So it could be associate producer, it could be thanks to, it could be
exactly
caterer.
Correct.
Okay. So, I mean, you are in investment banking. You know nothing, if not which sector to invest in. You know, you didn't invest in, say, you know, aluminum siding or hog bellies. If your friend had said, hey, you know, I know this hog farm in Kentucky, would you have done it? Or do you think this was a big deciding factor was that it's Hollywood?
And that was part of it. I mean, again, it's a relatively small investment, and Hollywood was definitely a big thing. But I think I would have examined a hog farm in the same way.
So now to the important question: have you, since you have invested this money, used your affiliation with this film to pick up women?
I'd have to say no, given my girlfriend of 1.5 years.
Oh, okay. So you're in a monogamous relationship.
Correct.
Absent that relationship, would you be telling people, yeah, I work in, you know?
Probably without question.
Okay. At least he's honest. Are you going to the premiere of Blue State?
Yeah, I will. I will. It's in Tribeca, so it's an easy trip, and I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll be looking for you on the red carpet at Tribeca. Zach Goldberg owns a piece of Blue State, and he's a good friend and a good friend of the business. Zach, thanks for being on the business.
No, thank you, Claude.
Coming up after a short break, The Writer Speaks. You're listening to The Business from NPR. This is The Business, and I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. The Writers Guild Foundation and Tall Fellow Press have published a book called Doing It for Money, The Agony and Ecstasy of Writing and Surviving in Hollywood. It's filled with essays from successful writers about the business of writing for film and TV. In the seventh installment of our ongoing series we call The Writer Speaks, John Sacred Young came down to our studio to talk to us. He co-created and executive produced the Emmy Award-winning series China Beach, and he wrote the feature films Testament and Romero.
The making of a film, which is often an experience, or can be, from hell, afterwards, in the aftermath, almost always turns into anecdotal heaven. And what writers do, and I think what, the book Doing It for Money is often about, is saying, hey, we love what we do, but it is often full of, you know, kind of a James Bond sequence where you're in the car behind the guy who is shooting at you or leaving nails in the road and your tires are exploding. But in retrospect, gosh, it's fun to talk about or write about. And along the way, you may get to meet some fascinating, not always nice, but fascinating, driven, intelligent, smart, talented people. Well, I think when you become, I mean, I started as a writer, and so you spend a lot of time in a room alone, and I spent 7 years failing with perfect success. But I also had this other side. I suppose it's the split personality, which is the side that liked to go out and hit people on a football field. And that comes in handy when you move from writing to producing. In television, you become a producer to protect your writing, and of course, maybe also as a corollary to make more money. And then I became a director because I didn't want to go through life going, well, I wrote that, and then he or she just look what they did to it, and, you know, whining and complaining and bitching. In feature films, the director is king, or as my son once said, as I was directing in Florida Keys, he said, Dad, how come all these people are listening to you? In television, it's usually the executive producer. So when I became eventually like the executive producer of China Beach, that you are, now it's called the showrunner. So you are in charge, and the director comes and goes usually. They're on for 8 days of shooting and some prep and some post, and then they're bye-bye. Whereas the producing staff and the executive producers stay for the run of the show.
Here's John Sacred Young reading his essay, The Actor with the Coffee Can.
He was just an actor carrying a coffee can. He was a carpenter as well as an actor with a coffee can, it turned out, and that was how he was making his living then. He was hired to play a high school biology teacher. It was $3,000 for a week's work, and he didn't fly. He arrived in Portland, Oregon, and at Reed College by bus for the shooting of my first pilot, a 90-minute one, an unusual length then and unheard of now. He had his coffee can and notes under his arm thicker than the script. The producer, a man prone to a richness of enthusiasm and riotous overstatement, called me even before the actor with the coffee can was hired. There's this guy in my office. He's great. He's sexy. He's perfect for the part, he said, and he's going to be a star. You got to come down right now and meet him. I was still falling off the turnip truck and occupying a cramped and abandoned cranny with fake pine panel walls and cottage cheese ceilings as black around the air conditioning ducts as the inside of an old fireplace. And where I came from, you don't drop everything to meet a, quote, sexy guy, unquote, no matter how perfect. I was to learn the producer said such things. He said such things about people I've never heard of since. He was an extraordinary creature and a great champion. He also thought screaming was whispering and arguing was breathing. The plague of AIDS wiped him out. Who never mentioned his father. At age 29, he had headed a studio and produced a violent and remarkable television series. For actors, it was a stepping stone into movies. 20-some years later, the series itself stepping stoned into an Oscar-winning movie. The studio refused to pay for a writer to go on location. It would set or break precedent. I was never sure which or why. The producer and director split my plane ticket, I paid for my meals, and I camped on the couch in the living room of the producer's suite. The hotel had never seen good days and was well into bad ones. The shag rug in the suite was the color of Trix cereal, pink, yellow, and orange. At night I could hear, or witness if I chose to look, the mice slaloming through the shag. The director called together a table read. He prided himself on his cool and his control, but quickly questions came my way. The script had a certain cadence, and I had a certain quality, and quickly I was sent away. Banished wouldn't be the wrong word, to do rewrites. I wasn't in the rubber room long before the phone rang. It was the director, and he wasn't cool and controlled. His voice was urgent and hissing whisper. I told everybody not to hire this guy. He's killing me. You're going to have to come down here right now. Before I could, the phone rang again. It was the first AD. The director couldn't wait, he said. He's sending the actor and his coffee can up to you. So the actor with his coffee can, who was a killer and going to be a star, knocked and came in and sat down in the only other chair. He was lean and intense and had a scar on his chin. His features were outsized and imperfect yet memorable. His hair was full and wiry, and his hands were tough and calloused from his carpentry. I was to learn he had completed 2 movies. They were in the can and had been a long time. They were talked about sometimes, hopefully, sometimes mockingly. No one knew what would happen to them, and he was broke. I was to learn both movies would be remarkable and groundbreaking. I was to learn he lived down the street from me on the corner of Woodrow Wilson Drive in the Hollywood Hills. I was to learn many things when he would come up and sit in my kitchen overlooking the canyon and smoke a joint or two. But that was later. In the room, he set the coffee can on the shag rug and unshuffled his notes. He had questions about his role. He had a lot of questions. They were well thought out. He was very literal and very serious, and he was testing himself, the role and the reasons why he was doing it, and me. Me is me. Me is a stand-in for the once cool and controlled and now absent director. Credence was the issue. He wanted it and wanted to know if I had it. It wasn't so long before I ran out of truth and bullshit about the character, this biology teacher who was smart and savvy and had a secret. He was having an affair with a student. We reached the point where I said, I'll look at anything, but this is the way I wrote him and why. The actor looked at me and put down his wad of notes, all of them. Okay, that's done, he said. We had passed some kind of test. You'll look and you'll do what you're going to do. But there's one scene, and there's no choice about this one. I've got an idea that will make it so much better. The scene was a crucial one. In it, the biology teacher tempts a class of girls to come up and unscrew the top of a glass jar and reach a hand in. The jar has a spider in it, big, black, and thready-looking. Finally, one skittish and scared girl approaches the jar. The spider appears huge through the distorting glass. Timidly, she touches the top, starts to unscrew it. The teacher makes a sound, and she jumps a foot and scampers back to her seat. The class howls. The teacher pulls the spider out, and there's a reason it looks thready. That's what it is. Thread. Black thread. Black thread tangled into the shape of a spider. That's his point. Know what you're scared of and why. Don't base it on superstition. Most spiders do good. Few are poisonous. The actor felt the scene was bogus. It wasn't real, and he had the solution. He picked up his coffee can and took its top off and turned the can upside down and shook it. An item proceeded to plop onto the shag rug, a large and hairy item. A large and hairy item that sprang around the pink and the yellow and the orange. A large and hairy tarantula item. The actor with the coffee can had done his homework, been creative, used his initiative, and he was pleased. I managed somehow to stay in my chair and learned an essential lesson. I was going to have to convince this strong, intelligent, bus-riding star-to-be to see that this jumping item would legitimately terrify anybody and would completely upend and reverse the intended meaning of the scene. Or there would be no credence between us. The actor with the coffee can and I watched the tarantula jump around the room for a long time. The thread stayed in the scene. The actor with the coffee can went on to become Harrison Ford. And I don't know what happened to the tarantula.
That was John Sacred Young reading his essay, The Actor with the Coffee Can, from the book from the Writers Guild Foundation and Tall Fellow Press called Doing It for Money, The Agony and Ecstasy of Writing and Surviving in Hollywood. By the way, the show he was talking about was The Possessed, which, alas, was not picked up. And that's the business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email address is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Claude Brodesser-Ackner. We'll see you next week on The Business.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Business. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Treatment, a weekly conversation with some of the most influential and innovative people in movies and popular entertainment, hosted by film critic Elvis Mitchell. Check out the podcast of The Treatment at kcrw.com.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with super handling all-wheel drive. More at Acura.com/RDX.